Okay, hi everybody, and welcome to our 28th program. We're on page 114 of Letters on Occult Meditation, and this is the 28th of August. We're well into Virgo now. We've been looking at dangers associated with meditation. And I kind of have a list here of the dangers of inhibition, which means basically locking down the free flow of energy within the mental body. And then there's atrophy, which is about allowing being so focused mentally that one allows the emotional and etheric physical vehicles to go unattended and to be diminished in their work. Dangers to the physical brain, dangers to the nervous system, dangers to the sexual organs, dangers from the karma of the student, and dangers based on national heredity and body type. Now we're into a new type of danger, the dangers attendant on group affiliation. This letter was submitted August 2nd, 1920, 100 years ago. So let us work on that. Very briefly, he says, I wonder if I can kind of increase. Whoop, that's just too much, isn't it? Right. Yes, so here we are again. Dangers attendant on group affiliations. And let's see what he means by that. Very briefly, would I seek this morning to take up the question of the dangers involved in meditation that are incidental to a man's group affiliations, whether exoteric or esoteric? Maybe this is some kind of danger that normally we might not have thought of. There is not much that can be said on this particular matter, save broad indications. Each of these various subjects that I have touched upon might warrant the writing of a weighty treatise. He sees so many possibilities of describing in detail, but he can't do that. He basically, given the time that he has to basically outline the main points of what he would seek to have us think about. A weighty treatise, and I shall not therefore attempt to cover what might be said, but only point out certain aspects of the matter that will, if pondered on with care, open up to the earnest seeker after truth many avenues of knowledge. So he is leaving much to us and giving us, in a way, an outline that we are obliged to ponder on. All occult training has this in view, to give to the pupil some seed thought which, when brooded over, in the silence of his own heart, you know, and let us say, brooding, is rather a Re 2 technique. When brooded over in the silence of his own heart, will produce much fruit of real value, and which the pupil can then conscientiously consider his own. Because after all, he did come up with the thoughts himself, taking the seed thought and extending it according to his own light. What we produce through wrestling and strenuous endeavor remains forever our own and vanishes not into forgetfulness, as do the thoughts that enter through the eye from the printed page or through the ear from the lips of any teacher, no matter how revered. So we have to work at conceiving our own thoughts, wrestling into a greater measure of the light, and then the thoughts which occur to us, and hopefully those which are of real value, remain with us. And it's so true, you know, I was thinking about how I and maybe some other friends have worked at memorizing the Tibetan. Maybe 2 years ago, I had all the techniques of integration, techniques of healing, the third formula, other mantras, solidly in my memory, so that I could walk along and repeat them almost without error to myself. But, you know, life intervenes. And where are they now? Oh, yes, and the 14 rules for group initiation and the 14 rules for the individual. 28 rules altogether, solidly in mind. Where are they now? Because other things have come up. They have vanished into forgetfulness, and I probably could revive them more easily than what it took to at first memorize them. I probably could do that. But, you know, so much maintenance is required, so much repetition, whereas, let's say, certain difficult thoughts in the question of being and infinity and that third ray category of thoughts that I struggled to formulate without guidance, except for the ancient Brahmanical Vedic trend of thought, are with me, and I can reproduce them rapidly. So what the Tibetan, my experience tells me that what the Tibetan has said here is true. And that's the thing. Before we accept something as true, let us have the experience which indicates that something as true. One thing that is oft overlooked by the pupil when he enters upon the path of probation and starts meditation is that the goal ahead for him is not primarily the completing of his own development, but his equipping for service, to serve humanity. We enter with one thought in mind, and before long, we realize that our original thought was erroneous. Yes, we will be equipped to a degree. We will not complete our own development, but we will have sufficient development to aid, to assist. And after all, that's the important thing. In the labors of Gemini, in the labors of Hercules, Hercules did not have in his hand the golden apples of the Hesperides and then go to work helping. First he helped, and the golden apples of certain knowledge only then came to him. His own growth and development are necessarily incidental. They will occur, but they are not the goal. Well, I think we've heard this many times, and, you know, it's a question of whether we live by that idea, whether we know it to be so. Otherwise, we could just keep going forever, accumulating, learning more and more without application. And that would lead ultimately to defeat, to becoming crushed under the load of knowledge that we have acquired. Because there's something about service that sets everything in circulatory motion so that we are not excluded from the divine circulatory flow. We are integrated into it. So if we ever think, oh, I don't know enough to serve, maybe one more seminar, one more book will equip me so I can serve and impart what I do know, we know we are following an erroneous assumption. We serve with what we have at the moment. And because that creates a kind of a vacuum, more knowledge pours in. To those who give all is given. It's not just about money. To those who give all their knowledge, or the most givable part of it, impartable part, more knowledge pours in so that they may give again. Of the aspirant, we're saying that his immediate environment and his close associates on the physical plane are his objectives in service. And if in the endeavor to attain certain qualifications and capacities, he overlooks the groups to which he is affiliated and neglects to serve wisely and to spend himself, note that, spend himself loyally on their behalf, he falls under the spell of sinful pride and mayhap even takes the first step towards the left-hand path. He's not on it yet, but he could then more easily, symbolically, step upon the left-hand path more easily. That is, when compared to people who use in service what they have at the time they have it. So pause for a moment and think, which really is another way of me saying meditate. About whether we give what we have or whether we are ever in the acquisitive mode, accumulating more and more, so that the strain of knowing grows greater and greater, and even is it true knowing unless one gives it? Can true knowing arise if one does not give what one has? And I think I'll put that down. Can true knowing arise if one does not give what one has in the moment? Unless inner growth finds expression in group service, the man treads a dangerous road. Well, you know, to accumulate and to have much compared to the little that others have can induce a prideful response. Unwarranted prideful response. Just imagine if the great ones compared themselves to us and measured what they have compared to what we have. But no, Master DK says, except for the development of certain faculties, I'm just like you. I think that's the way to consider it. Ultimately, there is no difference along the horizontal axis of being and brotherhood. Vertically, there is a difference in experience and in the accumulations which experience has made possible. But those things are overcome in time and space. And, you know, we can't blame a child for being a child. I'm 20 and you're 5. So I blame you for being 5 because you're not 20. You haven't learned what I've learned in my 20 years. Why? Because you're 5. And that's the way we have to look at those who have less experience than we and less opportunity to build up faculty. We can be sure that we are looked at in a similar way by those whose accumulations and experience dwarf ours entirely. Now we have here three types of affiliated groups. We're talking about the dangers of group affiliation. These are dangers in meditation, and they come from our group affiliations. Perhaps, says the Tibetan, I could here give some indications of the groups on the various planes to which a man is assigned. And this, you know, will be interesting because we actually give credit to far fewer groups than the ones with which we may be affiliated or in which we function. These groups are many and diverse, and at different periods of a man's life may change and differ as he works out from under the obligating karma. That governs the affiliation, works out from under. It almost seems like Pluto is at work, along with Saturn, you know, become kind of a grave digger for unexpiated karma. And so naturally, the groups in which we participate change. I think of some of the or the groups in which I participated, and I couldn't imagine myself doing so now. Things have moved on. Works out from under the obligating karma that governs the affiliations. There are other types of obligation. I was quoting this morning that French statement, noblesse oblige, nobility obliges. If you have a superior accumulation, you are obligated to use it for the edification of others and to promote a similar accumulation in them, or equipping, or building of faculty. So it's not, what we do is not just a question of our karma, but of our dharma as well. That for which we are created in the matter of expressing an aspect of the divine plan. We have a purpose, and that purpose is not about what we owe, what we've done amiss, what we've done correctly. It's about our energy placement within the wholeness as the plan moves towards manifestation. Well, is karma green? It really has something to do with the third aspect of divinity. And returning to incarnation each time we find certain unfinished business left behind. And it's the contained within the atomic triangle and the vehicles built by the atomic triangle of mental unit, astral permanent atom, and etheric permanent atoms, oftentimes referred to as the physical permanent atom. So we have to examine the groups that we are affiliated with and see wherein danger might lie as we attempt to pursue the suggested meditative process. He goes on. Today my computer froze a few hours ago. I don't want it to happen now. Let us remember too that as man enlarges his capacity to serve, he at the same time increases the size and number of the groups he contacts till he reaches a point in some later incarnation when the world itself is his sphere. So what we're doing here is comparing the sphere of service. To conditions earlier when we did not have such a sphere. If you look back at what your earlier life, maybe your sphere of service has expanded. if you have intimations about your previous incarnations, maybe you notice that in this life, your sphere of service has expanded until, you know, eventually it's the whole planet, but it wouldn't stop there. In expanding the sphere of service, one ring pass knot after another is extended or destroyed. Eventually, the entirety of cosmos becomes our sphere of service, even as it is for the universal logos. And of course, since we re-become in awareness the universal logos, that the sphere of his identity is the sphere of service. So we're in this process wherein the increasing of the size of the number of groups contacted indicates an expansion of the sphere of service. So later and to come, the world itself will become our sphere of service, even as it is for the Dragon of Wisdom, our planetary logos, and for all the lesser dragons of wisdom, the masters, that is, who are attempting to help the greater dragon execute the work within his sphere of service in the right way. He has to serve, says the Tibetan, in a threefold manner before he is permitted to change his line of action and pass on to other work, planetary, systemic, or cosmic. So even in this life, just compare. What was your earlier personality sphere of service? Because usually that's what appears first. It's the rare soul for whom the eventual soul sphere of service appears early on. How does your present sphere of service compare to the sphere of service, or at least involvement and activity, which appeared when you became a more integrated personality and could work as an effective person in the world? And, you know, maybe you will find yourself reaching more people, reaching them with greater depth, reaching them in such a way that you can more effectively help them align with the divine plan. I mean, it's up to you what you see. But the master, of course, looks on and he does see. He does see what we've done with our talents. He sees if we've been given 5 talents, do we produce 10? When the master goes away, so to speak, during the time of an incarnation, if we've been given 2 talents, do we produce 4? Or do we hide the talent if we've been given 1 for fear that it might be exposed and might vanish or might disappear. That would be the disloyal worker who did not multiply his talents and improve his effectiveness. Has your effectiveness in service improved? And there come certain decision points in the life where, if the correct decision is taken, the sphere of your service would expand and deepen. And if not taken, you know, we'll be thrown back into the more into the dweller state of consciousness, and we will hover on the threshold of divinity, but not pass through the electrical door, through similarity of vibration with that which is on the other side of the door. Speaking, of course, in symbols. So anyway, the man has to serve in a threefold manner before he is permitted to change his line of action and pass on to other work, planetary, systemic, and cosmic. We can say that Saturn guards the way and prevents premature passage. And we must say fulfillment before passage. You know, sometimes try as you might to change your sphere of activity and your sphere of service, something holds you. It's often Saturn and karma, and you say, well, I just can't. I have to take care of certain things before I can move on. And if you do mistakenly move on before you fulfill what has been given to you to fulfill in an earlier sphere, you regret it, and you simply have to come back under more difficult circumstances to fulfill that which was left behind in an unfinished state. Those choices confront us. And I hope we do not waste time by leaving behind what we have only partially accomplished as part of our soul assignment. So, what are the three methods that serve in a threefold manner? Now, DK will kind of develop this idea. Excuse my voice, I've been talking constantly. Mercury on the midheaven, you know, there are liabilities to that position. Well, he serves first through activity, through the use of his intelligence, through the higher, high faculties of mind, and the product of his genius, largely that means the content of his causal body, to aid the sons of men. He builds slowly great powers of intellect, and in the building overcomes the snare of pride. He learns to know how little he in fact knows. Whoops, how did infinity get there? He takes then that active intelligence of his and lays it at the feet of collective humanity, giving of his best for the helping of the race. It's, you might say, continuous from the seventh petal of the egoic lotus, ruled by Libra, and the third ray. So he's offering up his growing intelligence on the altar of service to the human race. So that's the first sphere. That's the first sphere of threefold service. Next. He serves through love, becoming, as time elapses, one of the saviors of men, spending his life, note that spending, you know, giving forth to acquire something needed, something higher, spending his life and giving of his all through perfect love of his brothers. Can you spend yourself in love? Love can flow forth. And it is a radiation of energy. So I would say, yes, you know, you can. And first must come intelligence. He serves through love, becoming, as time elapses, one of the saviors of men. Spending his life force, and giving of his all to those who give all is given, giving of his all through perfect love without mixed motive, through perfect love of his brothers. Life then comes when the utmost sacrifice is made, and in love he dies that others may live. A great sentence, and one that connotes the fourth initiation. Initiation four. He dies that others may live. Well, that's the whole Christ theme, isn't it? Now, of course, it was Master Jesus who died in the conventional way, but what was the death through which the Christ passed as he relinquished his own methods and said, "Not my will, Father, but thine be done." So sometimes you might say, well, Jesus had it harder because he went through an agonizing death and lost his body and suffered in great pain. But can we honestly assess the death, the kind of death that the Christ went through to pass into the Chohanship, the sixth initiation, and to become a member of Shambhala? Just think, as high as he was, already head of the hierarchy, probably since around 500 BC, he was still not yet a Chohan until he ascended. Now, probably so many events in that life were part of the ascension, but we do have him being gathered up into a cloud, as it were, And that's the only way in those days. His disciples of limited thought and limited esoteric understanding could describe his disappearance at the ascension. All right, so that's yet another mode of service. Activity is one, and the easiest, closest to humanity. And love is another. What is the third? He serves through power. Well, it's pretty much a 3-2-1, isn't it? He serves through power, and now the returning Christ will more readily display the power aspect along with the love and the wisdom and the activity in service. Christ is such a great being that we really cannot conceive the nature of his being in any kind of fullness, as much as we might like to. But when we practice possessing the mind as it is in Christ, we will approximate his attitude, and by passing through life regulated by his attitude, we will learn of those things which were simply words to us before. Proved in the furnace to have no thought save the good of all around. The furnace, the burning grounds, the purifying fire, the dross burnt away, the dross of selfishness, the dross which is thought of the good of himself before the good of others. He is trusted with the power that follows from active love, intelligently applied. Pause and reflect on your life. Do we have no thought save the good of all around? It's a consummation devoutly to be wished, but unlikely, because as has been stated in the Glamour book, when comparing the presence, the soul, and the dweller, we are still pretty much identified as that radiating third aspect vehicle or point of tension called the dweller. He works with the law, 1 and 7, governing the path of initiation and also the rays of law, and bends all his will to make the power of the law felt in the threefold realms of death. That's how DK slips in yet another perspective on the location in which we live. We are in, are we not? And think of it. Bouncing around there, but maybe that'll be better. We are in the threefold realms of death, even now, which is the threefold unprincipled field of the personality when cosmically considered. The threefold unprincipled, okay, what will that be? The threefold unprincipled field of the personality. We are in the realm of death, and then to die by entering into that light wherein consciousness awakens, free from the bonds of flesh. This is a quotation of the Tibetan to Jean-Mon Chartres. I'm always forgetting the letters. Maybe PD something. He was that Jesuit that was killed by the Nazis. To enter into that field of light is not death. It is part of the revelation of the eternally lovely secret of death. So death is life, and normal containment of the vitality to the worlds of form is death to consciousness. So we are living, walking, breathing in the threefold realm of death. In all these three branches of service, you will notice that the faculty of working with groups is one of paramount importance. These groups are diverse, as before I have said, and vary on different planes. Let us briefly enumerate them. Well, you remember, I think it's page 39, we have subtle groups listed. Note these groups. And I will try to be present in the right way. Seven great groups on the monadic plane, 14 elevated groups on the atomic subplane, the first of the atmic plane, two collections of triadal groups on the Buddhic plane, the one on the third, first subplane, 21 groups there, and the one on the third subplane, first and third. The third has 28 groups. I do believe we are counting from above to below. And then the groups proliferate once the mental plane is reached, and we're here talking about the higher subplanes of the mental plane and their groups. 49 groups, third subplane. Well, let's start from the top. 35 groups, first subplane. And so they have a connection with the 35 vortices which make the master. 42 groups on the second subplane. And so these groups have a connection with the 42 vortices of force which make a Chohan. I mean, where the numbers are the same, you really do look for lines of connection. And then on the normal third subplane, where the causal bodies of most human beings are found, we have 49 groups. And interestingly then, this particular grouping must be related to the 49 vortices of fire, which are accumulated by the time we reach the atomic subplane of the higher mental plane. Well, no, the atomic subplane of the cosmic physical plane. 49 vortices make up the vehicles of the kinds of beings who have achieved logoic, planetary logoic development in full, at least on the cosmic physical plane. There's still more to develop, but cosmic physically, when there are 49 vortices of fire, there is a completeness in the vorticular equipment of the initiate of the seventh degree. Now, who knows? Do the vortices go on onto the cosmic astral, cosmic mental, and so forth? My thought tells me, yes, they do, but I have no way of proving that, except the vortex is the means by which higher animating and inspirational energy reaches the lower existences. So I rather do expect to find chakric vortices on the cosmic astral and cosmic mental and so forth. I think it's one of the ways that God, the universal logos, descends into diversity. I think because the descent into diversity is involutionary, but it leads to an evolutionary re-ascent and to a gathering of material that is vibration and general encounter and experience that was not in the possession of the universal logos when first it was extruded from the state of super universal absolute infinitude. All right. So what else then? Well, the Tibetan's good at understatement. I've given a few hints here. Maybe quite a few more than a few. And while we cannot follow out every hint, we have to follow out those that really hit us. And we feel the impact of what we've read, but we don't know exactly why we feel that impact. So we have to investigate. All right. I was thinking from Bethlehem to Calvary, we have to prove ourselves in Bethlehem, as limited as it may seem to us. It's our original home, and we cannot run from Bethlehem out onto the world stage and say, I'm going to do big things, and not the little things at home. Because we build no foundation for those bigger things unless we fulfill Bethlehem, the house of bread. It's true that man does not live by bread alone, but it's necessary to fulfill the sustaining function of those who are less powerful and more vulnerable than we are, often our children and relatives, and that will prepare us to encounter the bigger tasks. He who is faithful in little is also faithful in much. So watch for the little things, because they give a hint as to how the larger things will be handled. And they are a check in humility against an overweening attitude. That's one of the things that the Cancerian Virgoan home life provides, a kind of reduction to humility through understanding the basics of life. Otherwise, we're left in the air without being able to ground the higher impulses. So in all these three branches of service, you will notice that the faculty of working with groups is one of paramount importance. Did you notice that? Did I notice that? Let's see. We don't know where the next foundational piece of information will come from, nor how it will fit, but it will come and it will fit. We have to have an alertness to the little thing, which may indicate a much bigger thing. You know, from one point of view, the old saying, the smallest grain of sand can stop the largest wheel. Well, that's the negative, but the possibility is the smallest unit of information can complete a puzzle which leads to the acquisition of much higher and deeper and more expansive pieces of information as we try to pursue an understanding of the great science of relations. So these groups are diverse, as I have said, and vary on different planes. Let us briefly enumerate them. So what are the groups to which we belong? And, you know, because we're talking about dangers arising from the disciples or the aspirants group affiliations. So number one, on the physical plane, the following groups will be found. His family group, to which he is usually affiliated for two reasons. One, to work out karma and repay his debts. And the second, to receive a certain type of physical vehicle that the ego needs for adequate expression, you know, in that impending life. We don't have that perspective yet, so maybe we don't completely know why we're born in a certain nation or a certain race. But karmic repayment is one, and on the more positive side, the qualities of that kind of body are needed. Okay, these are the groups. His associates and friends, the people his environment throws him with. Just think, you know, when you're in grade school and you're coming in with people who are all born more or less in the same year and are now taking the path of education together. Where did you know these people? Because you probably did. So we are thrown together with various people in our environment. So let's call this here the general family group, which we usually consider to be our main group. At least for a long time it is, and we have to learn how to leave the family group in its proper place. It doesn't mean to ignore it, but to get on with groups perhaps at a higher turn of the spiral. All of this has to do with the third aspect of divinity. I was thinking about that green interval, you know, the note fa. I don't have my pitch pipe here right now, but it's the sort of here comes the bride, bum bum ba ba, wedding march. It lays the material foundation for the continuance of the race. And it has to be in some measure associated with the sacral center, which provides the physical body and also the concrete mind at first. Another group, his associates and friends, the people his environment throws him with. Can't help it, you know. You enter school, let's say, at the same time as others your age enter school. You live in a certain neighborhood, maybe, on a certain block, and certain people live there too, and you are thrown together. His business associates, you want to pursue a certain type line of work, a certain profession, and there you are with others who necessarily become your associates due to shared interest. His church affiliations, maybe your family is religious and you've chosen a certain denomination of church to attend. And there you find the others, and you are affiliated with them in terms of your religious pursuits. And again, maybe old affiliations are coming forward. His acquaintances and casual friends, these are friendships based largely on personality, we are told, in Treatise on White Magic, and the people he touches for a brief period and then sees no more. Well, you can almost imagine walking on one of the busy streets. I was always amazed when a child to go downtown in Chicago and find the sidewalk so crowded with hundreds of people. In a way, you're rubbing elbows, but it's just a passing relationship. And oftentimes we gather in groups or little crowds with people that are no more to be seen once the little gathering is over. So these are kinds of affiliations, some of them deep and of long antiquated origin, and others super casual. so that there is nothing really to hold you together in friendship, nothing deep, and maybe nothing even shallow. His work with them is twofold again. First, to repay an obligation should such a debt have been incurred. And secondly, to test out his powers to influence for good those around him, to recognize responsibility and to direct or help. So even in relation to the more casual, hardly even friendships, but acquaintances, we can see that our association, even under these casual circumstances, has a rather definite outworking. Okay. So karma and dharma are at work in all of these associations, however casual. Family bonds are very, very close, but as we move from Cancer to Aquarius, the bonds of friendship, due to affinity, maybe become closer, and closer still, the bonds of relationship due to shared dharma, or duty, or work in the world. Okay. So his work with all of these is twofold. First, to repay an obligation should such a debt have been incurred, and secondly, to test out his powers to influence for good those around him, to recognize responsibility, and to direct or help. So, first, to repay an obligation. Let's put that, you know, in purple. I love the colors, but they don't show so well. And secondly, to test out his powers to influence for good those around him, to recognize responsibility, and to direct or help. I'll kind of put that in the second ray color. So in doing thus, the guides of the race find out the actions and reactions of man, his capacity for service, and his response to any surrounding need. We are being tested out all the time, and we are being observed in terms of our responses. Who are the people with whom you've been thrown together? Who are the people you've met along the way, and either temporarily or for a longer period of time, have been involved in group affiliation? what has been your response to them. Okay. Thus far. Thud. Far we have family. Oh, come on now. Family affiliations. We have friends, associates, and more casual affiliations, maybe drawn from emotional proclivities, and then the associated band of servers. Maybe this ends up being the most important, most closely related to soul proclivities. He is associated band of servers. The group under some great one that is definitely united for work of an occult and spiritual nature. That's the last type of group that we're going to deal with here. Now, of course, you have to wonder what the dangers could be. Already you can imagine that family is often inimical to one's discipleship service, because there may be a physical bond, but psychologically, the parents, the siblings, and so forth may have many other objectives and be differently developed. But friends and associates based on emotional response are more superficial, and maybe the friends want to go one way, but your higher duties tell you you should go in a different way. Conflict, you see. So here are the associated band of servers. I'll put that, you know, in purple, which means it's got to manifest. It may be either a band of church workers among the Orthodox. Beginners are tried out here. You know, the hierarchy tests you first. And without proving something, either your fitness or your unfitness, the decision to accept or reject is not made. So trying out the beginners, it may be in social work, such as in the labor movements or in the political arena. It may be in the more definitely pioneering movements of the world, such as the Theosophical Society, the Christian Science Movement, the New Thought Workers, and the Spiritualists. I would add to this one branch of endeavor that may surprise you. I mean the movement of the Soviet in Russia and all the aggressive radical bodies that sincerely serve under their leaders, even when misguided and unbalanced, for the betterment of the condition of the masses. These are possibilities, where the trying out of our responses occurs and where our responses are noted. So in all the above, we are seen as subject to experimental experience, and our responses are noted. I think, you know, hierarchy is very careful. Maybe the master is looking in over a student, potential student anyway, once in 300 years, maybe even a longer period of time, until that student is drawing nearer and nearer to the note being sounded by the master's ashram, and then a more frequent supervision occurs. Supervision. Vision from above, and not even by the master first. It's the chela in the light phenomenon, whereby a senior disciple looks over and supervises and reports to the master. Such a relationship apparently existed between Master Kutumi, the initiate DK, and the aspirant Alice Bailey. And DK was the reporting disciple to his master, Master Kutumi. Under the law of economy, the work, the time of a master, dispensable time, is very carefully guarded. Because if it is not, then potential is set aside and is not fully developed. Time is of the essence, and that time must be as wisely used as possible. We have to also think of the disciple in a reflection of the master's consideration of time. Well, our friend Hercules, you know, he was running around looking for the golden apples. He would have been mistaken, though. Well, he did waste time with Nereus, whom he didn't recognize. He didn't waste much time with Antaeus, because he recognized glamour and lifted it up in the air a little bit, destroying its sustaining energy. He wasted time with Bucyrus, the false teacher. But at the same time, he learned the lesson of independence upon the spiritual path. So if you learn something, maybe that even in unfortunate circumstances, maybe the time is not wasted. He would have been wrong had he said, "I don't have time to look after Prometheus." He had better have time to look after Prometheus and learn to release the solar angel in his fourth encounter. And he would have been wrong if he had said, "Oh, I don't have time to help Atlas uphold the world, because I'm after the golden apples of the Hesperides. I'm after the apples of wisdom. So I don't have time for these acts of service along the way." That would be a serious mistake. There is no rush, there is no hurry, and yet there is no time to lose. Each pilgrim, sensing this, presses his footsteps forward until he finds himself surrounded by his fellow men. You know, it's the rules of the road. that those two should be memorized, and maybe they're not too hard to retain. So what we do with our time, is really a crucial decision. And you can pause. You can pause and reflect over your long life. Most people are mature people who enter into this field, at least mature in terms of their age. And you can discriminate what have been the time wasters, even now. Not just then, but now. Time wasters pursued simply because of habitual inclination. What do we wish we had not spent time doing? How would we have redirected, reorganized the use of time? I'm sure when an accurate vision of that dynamic is accorded, we will find that months and even years cumulatively have been wasted along the path. And really, the only thing you can do is say, well, when I face similar circumstances again, I will feel that inner warning, that inner yes or that inner no, that will advise me, am I about to enter a time-wasting enterprise? I think the numbers will be at first deflating, except that we will know, you know, that we've learned something through some kind of failure. Thus, on the physical plane, you have three groups to which a man belongs. He owes his duty to them, and he must play his part. Family, friendship, associates, and one's connection with testing progressive groups and actual progressive groups, about which there is no question. They are definitely progressive, and their virtues outweigh their liabilities. With the other types of progressive groups, there are a lot of mistakes being made, but still their motive is often correct. Now, wherein could danger enter through meditation? That is the question in this particular area of study. Simply in this, that as long as a man's karma holds him to some particular group, the thing that he must aim at is to play his part perfectly. I play my part with stern resolve, with earnest aspiration. Even though it's a small part, you know, I'm not going to rush out and save the world and leave the family in a mess. Bethlehem must be fulfilled before one can step out and look for the teacher and even become the teacher or the leader. That as long as a man's karma holds him to some particular group, The thing that he must aim at is to play his part perfectly so that he may work out from under karmic obligation and advance towards ultimate liberation. He's used that phrase, work out from under, seems to suggest pressure, confining pressure from above. Okay, this phrase suggests a confining pressure from above and advance towards ultimate liberation. Well, ultimate for any phase or any particular phase. Let's say mastership or arhatship. You know, those higher initiations which give what looks to us like ultimate liberation. They are never ultimate, even, well, maybe for any universe, the great Pralaya is an ultimate within the context of a universe. But in the matter of being, how does one improve upon being? One can improve one's access to the realization of being, but one does not improve the presence. The presence is the presence. There are many instances of the presence, and they are never the pure presence. We may have the presence of Sanat Kumara, or the presence of the planetary logos, or the presence of the solar logos, way beyond our conception to experience. But even those are limitations upon the ultimate universal presence, which is a severe, infinitesimalized limitation upon the presence of the super universal deity, which itself, because it is split into the observer and the observed, is a severe limitation upon the one and only presence, which is the absoluteness itself. Well, you know, just throwing in the theory here a little bit. So when the word ultimate is used, we have to say ultimate within a certain context, and otherwise not ultimate. So you've got to care, you know, where you are. What's the old saying? It's a good one for people who love gardening. Bloom where you are planted. It didn't originate with me, and I never would think of such a thing, but I've been connected with people who have the green thumb and made the transference from handling the plant kingdom to handling their own psychology. Bloom where you are planted. So let's see where we are here. As long as a man's karma holds him to some particular group, oh, I've got to take care of mother or my brother or my children. I've got to take care of them. I can't abandon them. As long as the karma, Saturn, holding you in place, holds you in place, fulfill that well. and don't evade it while pretending to perform it. So I'll put that in, don't evade while pretending to perform, so that he may work himself out from under the karmic obligation, the pressure that holds you down. Well, the confining pressure, the pressure that holds you in place. And advance towards ultimate, semi-ultimate liberation. Yeah. That's what we have to do. And again, you know, it's not necessarily pleasant. But it is necessary. Besides this, he must carry on his group with him to greater heights and usefulness. And let's just say, that's not it. We say that the progressive individual will uplift his group while being progressive. So the old saying, you know, if you rise, other rise with you. You may not even know who they are. If you fall, you drag others down, and you may not even know who they are. So we have that group responsibility to the unknown connected person. And maybe not just the person, but members of other kingdoms, the animal kingdom, the plant kingdom, etc. Therefore, if through meditation of an unsuitable nature, he neglects his proper obligation, he delays the purpose of his life, and in another incarnation, will have to play it out. It's kind of a horrific possibility, but I'm sure we can catch ourselves in acts of preferential neglect. Oh, I don't really want to do that now. Tomorrow, mañana, you know, I'll do it tomorrow. And then tomorrow never comes until it comes in another life. So you kind of wonder of the many things that we feel we have to do now, how many of them arise from neglect in the past. Maybe not possible to tell, but we could get a feeling about it. When you get that feeling, oh, I've just got to do this, even though it is onerous, difficult, not necessarily the most fun, it may be due to the unfinished business of the past, really unfinished in the past when it should have been finished. And there's the unfinished business of the past that couldn't be finished in the past and has to be finished now. If he builds into that group's causal body the composite product of the several lines, aught that has not its place properly there, he aids not, but hinders. And again, that involves a danger. So we are, I guess he's saying, you know, we are responsible to the content of the group's causal body. We are responsible to the content or for the content part of the group's causal body. And then it's nice to illustrate, which he does now. Let me illustrate, for clarity is desired. A student is affiliated with a group that has an overpreponderance of devotees, and he has come in for the express purpose of balancing that quality with another quality or factor, that of wise discrimination and mental balance. Well, one of his disciples has done that. Is it DLR? Is it a man by the name of Charles Hill, who had a most interesting combination of rays, first ray soul, fifth ray personality, fifth ray mind, sixth ray astral body, seventh ray physical body, very mental, but, you know, being essentially, I think, a second ray monad, he still had considerable sensitivity, even though all those hard lines were there. So he was introduced into the glamour group, I think. And everybody there, so many people there, had a very powerful sixth ray. I guess he was a counterbalance to much of that, and maybe he succeeded fairly well in being that counterbalance. But whereas success, I think, to a degree was his, it's not the case with all people. They can emphasize something the group doesn't need, or more of the same, you know, and they don't uphold the responsibility of building into the causal body what must be built in, the group causal body. So here's this person. He's put in a group of devotees. It just reminded me, because so many people in that glamour group needed something to connect them with the astral plane number six. They needed the sixth ray, and while he did have a sixth ray, that was his only soft line ray. And it connected with the astral plane. And I think he played the violin, you know. I mean, the ray chart that he has now does not entirely define the character. We've been building up in the causal body the result of many ray charts and many astrological charts, all of which have their lingering effect, passing through the present ray chart and present astrological chart. I don't think you can account for all you are or seem emphatically to be by looking at one ray chart and one astrological chart. It may describe some pretty prominent traits, but behind that, what else is there that is very essential and in a way has nothing to do with your present ray chart or horoscope, except maybe the solar ray, and which must be guided through your present ray chart and astrological chart into expression. What you are causally after millions and millions of years doesn't just go away and get totally veiled or covered by your present ray and astrological chart. You have to find that something that lingers and which you have built. So anyway, here is this individual, an example. a student, and there he is in a group. Because he has an overpreponderance, there's an overpreponderance of devotees, and he's supposed to balance. It's almost like he's talking about Charles Hill, who had Libra, I think, as the, it was the sun or rising sign. I think it was the rising sign. So hence the balancing ability. So that quality had to be balanced by this person, let us say. Wise discrimination and mental balance. If he permits himself to be overcome by the group thought form and becomes himself a devotee, following a devotional meditation and unwisely omitting to balance that group's causal body, he runs into a danger that he hurts not only himself, but the group to which he belongs. I always love it when the Tibetan gives a nice, juicy example which makes things super clear. And this he does. So we must see what the group needs and whether we can provide it with our own complement of energies, astrological and rheological, however that's spelled. So think about yourself now and the groups you know. What do they need? Are you, due to your recognition of what they need, are you helping them achieve it? I sometimes talk to my youngest son and I say, because he teaches or has taught philosophy and especially logic, and I say, well, why don't you come into one of our groups and give some lessons in logical thinking? Because sometimes people like ourselves get so swept away in a leap of faith that we don't think straight. And then maybe something from a more concrete logical thinker could be of assistance. So far, he's declined my invitation to teach symbolic logic to the esotericists. But it would definitely be something that could be added as a balance. Now, let's say the Alice Beatty groups have a reputation for intellectuality and for a slower development of the heart and a very emphasized development of the head, the mind. If one comes in and simply emphasizes more of the same, one is increasing the imbalance. But suppose it's the concrete mind, basically, that the group is well equipped with, and the new member comes in and emphasizes more of the abstract mind and how to reason purely from the abstract mental levels. Well, then that's providing a balance. So think about your groups. And whether you can carry something into their context, which will truly be fulfilling rather than emphasizing what is already unbalanced and there in abundance. Usually the question is, what does the group need? And what will supplement the possessions, the treasures of the group's causal body, so that a rounding out can occur? This was always happening in these groups. A bunch of, was it eight? At least eight first-race souls were brought into the Alice Bailey Tibetan, essentially second-rate group. Why? Balance. The second, and Alice Bailey herself said, thank goodness for Foster Bailey, who was first-race soul, a lawyer. And she says, I would have made so many mistakes, legal mistakes, without Foster. Foster Bailey advised her from the first-rate perspective, so she didn't make those errors. And then, I've mentioned it before, but when I asked the head of the Agni Yoga Society what master he felt he responded to and why, he felt he was responding to Master Kutumi on the second ray. Interesting for a very first-ray group. Madame Rorick was on the first ray, and some of the inheritors of her work were strongly on the first ray, and the teaching partner, so to speak, of the head of this Agni Yoga Society was clearly, you could see it, it was the first ray. You know, in all of its restraint, but definitely, you know, if you put a beard on him, he would have looked like Abraham Lincoln. There were some similarities there. But here was this man who basically had control of it all. And he said, well, I'm responding to Kutumi. So this is supplementation. This is balance. This is loaning certain rays to different ray ashrams for the purpose of helping to achieve balance. Mostly this is going on in terms of detectability between the first and second ray ashrams, but I'm sure we will find it in the other ray ashrams as well. So what about the balance of rays in ourself? DK sometimes remarks upon it. And what about the balance of rays in groups? So anyway, this is the example. An example. He neglects what has to be done on the stage which the soul has staged for him. He's been placed. You know, you kind of wonder how much choice we have about where we're going to be born and to which parents. And the old saying goes, well, you select your parents, but I'm sure your karma and your solar angel have a lot to do with that selection. You can't work out from under all karma at the same time, but maybe a certain part of working out is due at the present moment. And so with the greater perspective of the solar angel and your own onlooking and understanding to a certain degree, then the choice is made. What about number two here? This is the focus on the emotional plane. And here, he belongs to several groups such as, and we'll look for the danger, right? So we'll kind of use a rose color, you know? His emotional plane family, which is more thoroughly his own group than the family into which he happens to be born on the physical plane. You know, with my friends, I share a lot of similarities, which I don't share with my family at all. That's what's being said here. You will see this demonstrated many times in life when members of an emotional plane family contact each other on the physical plane, instant recognition ensues. So then comes the battle between the parents and the friends. And the parents have a tough time, more so than the one who is recognizing his emotional similarities with others. And sometimes, you know, this happens in adolescence, you know, in what we call in America high school, or maybe what we call in Europe gymnasium. Let's suppose you have a very staid family and you join a drama group with whom you share some kind of emotional exuberance. You feel at home there, more at home than you might in the physical confines of your family. You feel more at home with your emotional family than with your physically based family. Family is interesting because, you know, it gives the kind of rite of aggregation. You come together based on similarity of vibration. So we are speaking of coming together based on similarity of vibration. But sometimes, of course, the physical family or certain members of it and the emotional family have a lot in common. And sometimes a relative is a measure of both. I have a relative who's a member of my physical family, and I would say emotional family, but only partly due to Ray, a member of my mental family, or I of hers. We have very strong similarities in the charts, except for the ray of the mind and possibly the monadic rays. So there's never going to be complete mental family relationships characterizing that particular relationship. With another person in my physical family, I think I share very little in the personality, except maybe some reactive tendencies. But in terms of the mode of spiritual quest, a lot. But we'll get to maybe he'll talk about mental families. And another, I share strong emotional and mental similarities, but a much different approach to what might be called spirituality. It's all governed by the rays, not so much even by the astrological signs, but by the rays. And it's just very interesting to assess one's really close relationships and see which families are shared with that individual with whom one has a close relationship. We'll go on here. The class within the Hall of Learning to which he is assigned and in which he receives much instruction. So this is the curriculum of the Love Petals. The central petals of the nine. Petal 4, 5, and 6. So these are emotional groups. He's kind of saying we tend to be members of these emotional groups. And point C, the band of invisible helpers with whom he may be working, and the band of servers. This is the higher group. Within the emotional grouping, I've talked to some people who really have their memories pretty much intact about invisible helpership. And I was talking to one person who said, oh yes, we were there at the invasion of Normandy, holding the soldiers up in the water because they had these landing craft under a barrage of machine gun bullets. Very, you know, so many were killed, so dangerous. And the invisible helpers were there. It was an invasion of Europe with the objective of overcoming Germany eventually. But it wasn't just a physical assault, which was appreciable. There was help from the inside too. How are you helping? What is your assignment? Who are those with whom you are helping? Now, maybe there's, you know, a tendency to move on from emotional family affiliation into something higher. Let's see. So this is the class in the Hall of Learning to which he is assigned and in which he learns a lot, I guess. One day we're going to know all that we're taught on the inner planes, and it'll become familiar. He tells us that death is a most familiar experience. And, you know, such that we might end up saying, oh, this again. And maybe, you know, falling asleep past a certain point reveals that as well. And we'll recognize what we've been doing at night. You can get a lot done in a short period of time. But maybe it depends on one's polarization, one's focus. And maybe the strictly mental workers are already emphasizing other kinds of groups that are not, let us say, particularly emotionally based. So far, what do we have? Well, you know, I'll just have to kind of remember it. We have the outer physical family, and we have so far we have classifications within the general physical family and within the general emotional family, subdivisions. I mean, really, do we have an idea even of the families to which we belong? The conventional way of thinking is, this is my family, you know, physical. And it's really important here on the physical plane. But who are we working with? We don't necessarily stay in a family business, do we? Some people rebel. I have two brothers, and they stayed more or less in the family business for a while, and one permanently. We had different inclinations. Sometimes you stay in a context where you don't belong. But I had no business with that business. And I know of another or others who left two brothers in terms of interest and then got into something completely different, whereas the brothers stayed for many years in the family business. And then, interestingly enough, the youngest brother, who never wanted to be there anyway, gradually faded from it. So it's a type of non-growth to stay anchored in that which the physical family produces, and ignore the wider scene toward which the emotional family would incline. Such a battle goes on, you know, when in adolescence, when you're really finding your emotional family, and it may be quite contradictory to what's going on in the physical family. There may be conflicts. You know, don't bring your friends here. Don't bring them home. I can't stand them, you know, that kind of thing uttered from a parent, let us say, under, you know, not so understanding circumstances. But a big difference. Why are you associated with persons like that? They hold completely different values than our family holds. Why? Well, it's just that they are more members of the emotional family than the parents or other brothers may be. We're all of us so different, you know. When there are a number of siblings born in a family, they're carrying different astrology, different ray energies. No guarantee whatsoever that they will be in the same emotional family or mental family. So all these groups involve obligation and work, and all must be allowed for in studying the wise use of meditation. The master assigning meditation has to know what types of groups a person is naturally affiliated with. And let's just say the factor of obligation cannot be evaded. We have certain duties to our groups, and a number of these problems involve ignoring our duties. So we might say, ignoring our duties to various groups is an ongoing problem. Now, sometimes in the East, you know, or in the Ten Commandments, honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land. There's much of virtue in that, but at a certain point, one must honor one's own inner nature and understandingly depart from what otherwise would be a Saturnian situation in an oppressive mode. That would be problematic, to stay in a group that inhibited the expression to be found in a more extensive and subtle group. Meditation should increase a man's capacity to discharge his karmic debts, give clear vision, wise judgment, and a comprehension of the work of the immediate moment, and anything that militates against this is dangerous. So if, let's just say, you try to lead the meditative life, but the groups that you are members of inhibit leading that life, there is danger. You know, sometimes people grow and their friends don't grow, or at least they were in a phase with their friends that the friends will never transcend, but they transcend it. Then comes that tearing. I can't be with these people anymore. They used to be my friend. Friends, I don't know what happened. We just went our separate ways. Well, something awoke in you that has not yet awakened in them. So one has to depart. And the same thing with one's physical family. You know, you could, quote unquote, stay in the family business, which may be right for you, but it might be entirely wrong. And you have to depart. Otherwise, compromise your integrity. Maybe make your parents happy for a while until they can look on and say, well, you know, I'm looking back now, and when you wanted to be an actor, and I was so much against it, preventing you, insisting that you stay in the family business, I was wrong. I should have let you go. It's a drama that's happening all the time. So we have to know when is the right time to arrive, and when is the right time to depart? You know, I'm a classical musician, but I oftentimes like country music. And there's that song by Kenny Rogers, you got to know when to hold 'em and know when to fold 'em. Speaking of card games, poker probably. You have to know when you can hold your cards and hope for the best, because you have a sense of what you've got compared to what others have got. And you have to know when you just say, that's it for me. Fold your cards. There's so many practical lessons from the things we do and the games we play. And we're here to make a success of our soul inclinations. Anything that prevents us from doing that, really prevents us, is dangerous. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't do that when you're busy fulfilling your karma, because there's a lot of ways in which we can turn karmic obstacles into possibilities. Master Moria is forever speaking about that. Obstacles are possibilities. When will you ever learn that obstacles are possibilities? But sometimes obstacles are no possibilities. And they will just remain what they are unless you depart them. So anyway, meditation should help. Us deal with these apparent obstacles. And when there are blockages to our discharging of karmic debts and to the clarification of our vision and to the onset of wise judgment and the comprehension of work in the immediate moment, when we're really somehow blocked from dealing with these things, there is a danger. And there will be certain kind of groups with their culture that will prevent these developments here listed as valuable. Of course, if we are strong enough in spirit, we can probably make any obstacle a possibility, but oftentimes people are overcome by their obstacles. And finally, we get to the mental plane and the groups found thereon. And we can see, you know, what may be the dangers. So far, we've seen that, the dangers, one, fleeing group responsibility. And two, being truly stifled by a group from which one should have moved on. So far. Have we fulfilled our responsibility to the various groups of which we may be a member? Family responsibilities can go on a long time. And you can outgrow those with whom you originally had a very friendly and mutually supportive relationship based upon a certain level of appreciation and a response, certain orientation. You know, you used to go out with friends, do something, and you begin to lose interest. You don't know why. You don't want to do that anymore because something higher is calling to you. And then you split. It was an old song, and it has a line in it. Those wedding bells are breaking up that good old gang of mine. The song is probably 50, 60 years old. Meaning you have to move on to the phase of marriage and family and can no longer run with your friends. There's a duty, an obligation felt. It's time to leave that. And sometimes in a marriage, where are you going? Oh, I got to get out. Got to go out with the boys. Got to go out with the girls. You know, it's a kind of a, well, maybe one does. It's kind of a retrogression. It's a relief to get back to that old pattern. But we have to learn when to move on and to what. Now, the next thing here is the mental plane, the groups on the mental plane. And what are they? And what might be the dangers involved? Maybe something else, you know? Not that you fail to fulfill your duty, not that you are stifled. Something else, maybe. Let's see. These can be enumerated as follows. And generally, you know, we're climbing now into a higher types of groupings. The group of pupils of someone master to whom he may be attached and with whom he may be working. Well, Master DK had some 50, 51 students who were, in a sense, no matter what C group they were affiliated with, were all part of one group. This is usually only the case when the man is rapidly working out his karma and is nearing the entrance to the path, the real path, let's say, beginning at the first initiation. The path of aspiration is before the first initiation, path of probation, depending on how we consider it, maybe before the first initiation. The real path of discipleship is the path of probationary initiation. His meditation, therefore, should be directly under the guidance of his master. And any formula followed that is not adjusted to a man's need carries with it elements of danger, you know, inappropriate pursuits, even though they might seem to be spiritual. For the vibrations set up on the mental plane and the forces engendered there are so much more potent than on the lower levels. So these are mental groups, a sort of here discussed is a mental spiritual group affiliation. But stay under correct guidance and do not wander. The old story in Agni Yoga, the ambitious student thought he'd go faster if he had three teachers and not just one. So he arranged that, and he thought he was making progress with each teacher and would be ahead of the game, progressing faster. But then each teacher sent what is called a whirlwind to help the student fly. You know, some of this may be symbolic. And the student, not being able to handle these diverse currents or winds, was torn apart by them rather than progressing. So this also maybe is the arcane school's insistence that you follow one line of meditation with them and not diverse lines which can contradict. Not that there's necessarily anything wrong with the diversity, but there can be contradictions which the student does not handle well, and things can be moving spiritually but in different directions, and it can cause conflict and confusion and delay, non-accomplishment. You have difficulty becoming the one-pointed disciple. So I guess you have to know what to emphasize. So here it is. Any formula followed that is not adjusted to a man's need, as maybe a single master sees it, carries with it elements of danger. Danger through diversification. For the vibrations set up on the mental plane and the forces engendered there are so much more potent than on lower levels. So that's one kind of group to which we belong, and a danger affiliated with it. Something within you will warn you when you are treading the path of danger. It's kind of, you know, called maybe the inner monitor, the inner regulator. Maybe that's what that star Regulus is all about. If you have Regulus on the ascendant or conjunct your sun in Leo at the present time, self-regulation, according to law, will be an important strand, very important strand in your life. Conjunctions of the so-called fixed stars with important points in the chart can tell a story about the access of certain stellar energies, which have to be considered when considering the overall energy dynamics of your energy system. And B, and I showed you this on when it came to page 39 of this book, seven groups monad, 14 atmic, seven, and let's see, have I forgotten how many? Here it is. 14 groups atmic, 21 and 28 groups buddhic, and all the way up to 49 groups on the mental plane. These are the higher groups, and how we would know which ones of these to which we belong would be a real exercise in discrimination. And first of all, we'd have to define the kinds of pursuits that each one of these groups engages in, and that would not be easy. Maybe there are some hints when it comes to the higher mental plane, spiritual discernment, subplane 3, response to group vibration, subplane 2, spiritual telepathy, subplane 1. How does it go? Don't have subplane 1 on the buddhic plane. Or, well, go buddhic plane, no. The third subplane of the buddhic plane, idealism, I think. But nothing given on the first subplane of the buddhic plane. And the siddhi, the power there involved, may be very high indeed, such that it's not even the province of the master's application. When we get to the atmic plane, it's subplane 1, and we just don't know. If it had been subplane 7 through 3, we might know, according to what DK gave in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, page 188 or thereabouts. As far as the seven monadic planes, and it doesn't tell you, interestingly, it doesn't tell you what subplane. Could be a combination of subplane 4, subplane 3, subplane 2, subplane 1. Just the way below on the etheric plane we have, and on the astral plane we have that kind of division. And here I will demonstrate that. And that's it. Notice how there are seven, but four subplanes are involved. Now, are these seven monadic groups going to be found on the second subplane of the second plane, or will they be more distributed the way these chakras seem to be distributed? A three here, one on the higher subplane, another on the second subplane, another on the third subplane, with four, including the spleen, on the fourth subplane. Of course, what we could do, I think, is take away the spleen, and we could add another chakra or vortex on the first subplane that would represent the ajna center placed on one of the subplanes. But anyway, it looks like the higher four subplanes are the place where the activity is going on, and that somehow the seven on the monadic plane and the 14 on the atmic plane and so forth would be found in the what might be called the etheric portion of any plane, namely the higher four subplanes, just the way, given this entire cosmic physical plane, the etheric portion is the higher four cosmic subplanes. Okay. So the egoic group to which he belongs. Now, at the time this was written, probably this referred to the higher mental plane and not to any egoic or soul group on the Buddhic plane. This is important, for it involves the consideration of the man's ray in the apportioning of meditation, and it is a higher ray of the egoic lotus or causal body. This matter has already been somewhat touched upon, and it was touched upon in the early part of the book, around page 15, 16, 17, 18, right in there. As you will see, I have not specified certain dangers attacking any particular body. I guess maybe he doesn't want us to get too specific in our thought. It is not possible to cover the subject thus. The Tibetan has to learn, he does learn, he knows what to leave out. When there's just too much detail, we would be overwhelmed, and there's only so much time space in which we have to study and absorb. In later days, when occult meditation is more comprehended and the matter scientifically studied, students will prepare the necessary data. Let's see. And the treatise is covering the entire subject, as far as then may be. We're always limited by the time as to how much can be exposed. I sound, however, a note of warning. I indicate the way. The teachers on the inner side seldom do more. Remember what it says about China, its motto, I indicate the way. Interesting. And one day in China, Western China, an advanced school, sounds a lot like Tibet. We aim at developing thinkers and men, well, okay. Yeah. So, it goes on to say, we aim at developing thinkers and men of clear vision, capable of logical reasoning. To do this, we teach men to develop themselves, to do their own thinking, reason out their own problems, and build their own characters. Such is the path, with an ellipse and a period after it. So always maybe indicating something that is left out. Well, we're about to come in. To a new section. And, you know, I don't really know how long this has lasted, maybe about 2.5 hours altogether. And I'll try to carry on shortly, see if I succeed. We're going to August 3rd, 1920. We're on page 120. And this is August 28th, 2020. Hopefully we see, increasingly see, with subtle, see the subtlety, of course, but see with clear vision. There's another one of these dangers here that we're going to take up, but this looks like, well, let's see. Shall I stop? Maybe I won't. Maybe I'll just keep going. That might be a possibility. I think maybe I will. At least for a little while, keep going. Because we're still in the dangers connected with meditation. I may have to cut off at an ungainly point, because there's work to be done tonight on broadcasting from the Treatise on Cosmic Fire. Yeah. So I'll continue shortly. I do think I will go on a little bit, not too much, because there's a whole section that continues with dangers, but it's very long. And it's about the dangers of obsession. So I will leave that to its own program or two. And I'll just finish up here with the dangers arising from subtle forces. And we'll see what he has to say about that. Gosh, there's plenty of dangers, aren't there? We have for our topic this morning the final section of our letter on the dangers incidental to meditation. Well, it's quite a long section. We have dealt somewhat with individual dangers inherent in the three bodies. We have touched upon the risks that may be run when the karma of the student and his group affiliations are overlooked. That's the point, isn't it? That is the point. So here, in each body, there are problems, potential. And this is one that has to do with overlooking and neglect. And now, today, the subject involves real difficulty. We have to deal with the dangers that may arise from forces and persons, from entities and groups working on the subtler planes. And the difficulty arises in three ways. So, okay, this is about what is hidden. We begin to look at hidden dangers. Yeah. Okay, and these are hidden dangers. So let's look at the three ways why the difficulty arises. The ignorance of the average student as to the nature of those forces and as to the personnel of the groups on the subtler planes, the risk of revealing more than would be wise in an exoteric publication, and the occult risk that is little comprehended by the uninitiated. It lies in the fact that in the concentration of thought that necessarily arises in discussing these problems, thought waves are set in motion, currents are contacted, and thought forms circulated that attract the attention of those under discussion. And this may lead at times to undesirable results. Therefore, I shall with brevity touch upon the subject until the inner planes and needed light and protection are afforded. Upon the inner planes, the needed light and protection are afforded, but apparently not extending to circumstances on the outer planes. All right, I think I'll just take the three together. Like that, and boost them, and look at certain words that tell us what the problem may be. Ignorance is one. Who are the forces? What are the forces? Who are the personnel inwardly working? The risk of revealing. Okay, that's another difficulty. And the occult risk that is little comprehended. So attract the attention of those under discussion. And usually we're not in a position to deal intelligently or effectively with them. They are more powerful. So three groups of entities. These groups of entities can be differentiated in a threefold manner. Let's see what we have here. Upon the inner planes, the needed light is there, and that is good. I would say that where we are, that inner light is not afforded. The protection is not afforded. So always DK has that sheltering attitude of the second ray, not out of proportion, but at least guarding his students. He tells us of the second ray soldier or commanding officer that he would never needlessly send his soldiers into danger, knowingly do so. And it's the same here. He's kind of the director. He is the director of our approach. And he's not going to needlessly send us into danger or attract forces we cannot handle. So, three difficulties we have discussed. We have to deal with the dangers that may arise from forces and persons, from entities and groups working on the subtle planes. Sometimes we're told that they war militantly against the efforts of the aspirant and attack his vehicles and sometimes all vehicles at once. So here are these groups. Groups of entities can be differentiated in a threefold manner. And here we're going to take them up. Let us take each division and deal with it carefully, first laying the foundation of knowledge by pointing out that the dangers arise from a threefold condition of the bodies of the student, which may be the result sometimes of meditation. Okay. And these conditions are, number one, let's see, what do we have here? Yeah, well, I'll number these, even though they are not numbered in the books. A negative condition that makes the entire three bodies of the personality receptive and quiescent and open to the attack of the watching denizens of other planes. You know, those who live in the dens of evil, denizens. And then number two, so we cannot, you know, we have to have a certain positivity that resists those incursions. And we've been told by Master Moria that the heart center is a great protection in all matters of obsession. Number two, a condition of ignorance or foolhardiness that in attempting to use certain forms and mantrams without the permission of the teacher involves the student with certain groups of devas, bringing him into contact with the devas of the emotional and mental planes, and making him, therefore, through his ignorance, the butt of their contact and the plaything of their destructive instincts. Well, this has something to do with the white magical work. We're told the magician may die of drowning. It's the wrong relationship with the Agni Suryans, and maybe that poisonous, gaseous condition of the mental body that comes about when it is overly crowded. What else? I'm just putting numbers here because I think it will help us keep straight. A condition which is the reverse of the above, which makes a man positive and a channel, therefore, for force or power. So, you know, let's just say, the opposite of vulnerable negativity. When this is the case, the man proceeds. Let's see, negativity. When this is the case, the man proceeds under occult rule or law, and with the aid of his teacher, to wield the electric fluid of the inner planes. Minds one a little bit of the special effects in the Harry Potter movies, in magicians' battles, the wielding of etheric fluids through wands and so forth. Okay, I'm going to make this a little bigger so it stands out. He becomes then a center of attention of those who strive against the brothers of light. Well, that doesn't sound like he's violating any law. It sounds like one of the hazards through which the developing initiate will pass. So we have the condition of foolish experimentation, let's say, we have the condition of a negative condition, which is, we might call it undue passivity. And we have the condition of growing power, which is also attracting the attention of those who strive, war against, the brothers of the light. The The first two conditions are all the result of meditation, unwisely and ignorantly practiced, and the last state of affairs is frequently the reward of success, but can lead to difficult experiences. So, indicating the success of the initiate. Wrong meditation through the use of certain forms that the disciple has no business using, and prematurely bringing him in contact with devic forces he can't handle, passivity, foolhardiness, and successful wielding that makes him stand out. These internal forces do exist, invisible though they may be to us. So the first two conditions are all the result of meditation. We approach passively, we approach in a foolhardy manner. So approaching passively or approaching in a foolhardy experimental manner, unsupervised, and the last state of affairs is frequently the reward of success, being able to confront or being required to confront these negative forces. I remember in case of the disciple RSW, she was told, yes, there is an attack being instigated against you internally. However, I could stop it. I could prevent it, says the Tibetan, but thereby you would learn nothing. Okay, in the first two, the remedy lies within the student himself and in the wise correction of the type of meditation and its more careful following. So we don't want to meditate our way into trouble by incorrect methods of meditation or methods that are unsuitable to us. We use forms and mantras which might be better for others, and we use them for ourselves and get into trouble. In the third case, the remedy must be sought in various ways, which I will later indicate. Now begins a lengthy section. Which I think it not wise at the moment to pursue. I don't want to mix too many subjects together here. And this is of such an interesting nature. It's a whole subject in itself. And, you know, leads into questions of exorcism, the way it is practiced in the Catholic Church. It's rather complex, rather long, and It leads up to this point, through 8 pages, to dangers arising from the Deva evolution. And we'll see how far that goes. Dangers from the Dark Brothers. Goodness, the number of dangers. And I think this is, well, the Dark Brotherhood maybe has something to do with the dangers of meditation, but maybe it's a subject all on its own. Taking us all the way up to letter four. So I imagine, letter six rather. So I imagine that a few programs will be found here because we have to cover 18 pages. That's quite a bit. And I think there's no sense to extend it. There are three big subjects, the dangers of meditation, of obsession, the dangers from the Deva evolution, the dangers from the Dark Brotherhood. So we'll stop here. And this has taken us basically from 114 to 121, and now we'll work from 121 onward, and we'll see when I can do that. Well, what is instilled in us? Maybe a very healthy respect for the area that we are entering. From every side and from within ourselves, the dangers arise. So we don't want to be characterized by that old saying, fools rush in where angels fear to tread. I wonder, do angels experience fear? Maybe. Maybe a certain class of them. Fear is a certain inhibitory vibration. And maybe it's not just limited to human beings, because it seems to be built into the very substance of the planet itself. So when we undertake meditation, we cannot any longer be ignorant of these matters. We have to know something about what we might encounter. And we have to be very wary. I don't mean paranoid. I don't mean always suspicious. But I do mean vigilant. Because we can arouse certain conditions in our vehicles. We can ignore certain duties using meditation as an escape, and we can be preyed upon by those forces which are warring militantly against the progress of the aspirant. We can see how, you know, the curriculum for the new esoteric schools is being prepared by the Tibetan. Those schools, in their true mode, are not going to appear right away. We're simply in a bridging period. Bridging towards the real new schools, which will be more active, and even then, beginning in a small way, under the supervision of externalizing masters, at least behind the scenes, and taking place within the consciousness of the Christ. So we can't rush the whole proposition, but we can learn something about the microcosm and, by extension, the macrocosm, because the schools and their two divisions will deal with those two areas, microcosm and macrocosm. We're getting some foundational knowledge that maybe with what the Tibetan gives out before long will be really useful in stabilizing our approach to the knowledge which must come to us during the Aquarian Age and the pursuits which then can be activated. So we're still in the rehearsal stage, the preparatory stage, and there is much, much, much to assimilate. And that's what we are attempting to do. I mean, DK has written so much that no one is going to assimilate it all. And we have different rays and work along different ray lines. But we can assimilate far more than presently is assimilated in our consciousness. And this little book, well, maybe it's not so little, it really is a foundational book for all of our spiritually esoteric, spiritually occult pursuits. So let's work very hard over the next 5 years as the great conclave approaches on the inner side of life. Because there will be many changes that are the result of this conclave. And the more we understand, the more we can help others understand. Many bewildering things may happen and be wrongly interpreted if we do not become educated ourselves about the nature of these potential changes and help others similarly be educated. So I'll get into this whole question of obsession and the dangers from the Dark Brotherhood and the dangers from the Deva Kingdom and what he wants to say to us at this early phase of the writing about the Dark Brotherhood. Sometimes, you know, thought currents are set up and they do attract attention. And then it's very important that, as DK said, we be marked out for protection, because we really can't yet handle those kinds of attacks. And since the reappearance of the Christ work is so crucial to the divine plan, especially those who are working assiduously on the reappearance project and the externalization project, are marked out for protection. Because they will be maybe among the first to be attacked. We don't want to get into a paranoid state of mind where there's a dark brother hiding behind every tree. You know how it gets, how paranoia can become an obsession in itself. But we do want to be wary And we do want to be vigilant, because these subtle enemies do exist. And the fact that we cannot customarily see them renders them even more effective. Okay, so I'll move on to the next subject when the time is indicated, and hopefully before long. Meanwhile, you know, the Tuya and I and the whole communications team are sending you a lot of love and blessings and encouragement to go as deeply into these matters as you can and as your time allows. Many decisions have to be made about how you will spend yourself, you know, how you will spend your time, how you spend your substance, not your energy, and you know, not just the money. Spending applies to a lot more than money. It's all about the direction and flow of energy. So let us hope that we all choose aright in this regard, because the attention of the Dark Brotherhood will be very focused in the next 5 years. They want to thwart the good effects of the Great Conclave, and they certainly want to delay the externalization and reappearance. Probably, in a sense, they know they can't, but they want to frustrate the manifestation of the divine plan, and they don't know about it in every particular. And so they seek to find out, we are told. We don't want to be part of that kind of disclosure. We want to keep our silence when it comes to inappropriate spreading of that which may reveal itself as a part of the divine plan. And at the same time, we want to make sure that the plan progresses. Okay, onward then. And as soon as I can, I'll take up this. And now we're really getting into the occult, as it were, you know, these hidden enemies. Even your horoscope will show hidden enemies in the 12th house, or hidden protection in the 12th house. It all depends. Mars in the 12th house for an occultist can be the militant warring of the hidden enemy against your process. Jupiter can bring protection, and Saturn brings caution. Well, there's a lot to be said, so, and a lot to be thought about. We'll see you soon then. Bye-bye.